Welcome on to the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, post-draft edition. I'm sure everyone is really excited with the player that their team drafted, and I am here to tell you that nearly all of those guys will be terrible this year. Joining me to also make that statement is Danny LaRue. What's up, Danny?
Doing well. It was exciting to have a draft despite there being no big trades, though I'm sure we'll talk about the ones that did happen.
Yeah, and, I don't mean to be overly dismissive of these rookies. The draft is incredibly important. Using your draft picks well is probably the number one thing you can do to be good as a franchise, other than attracting free agents who are max players. But that said, just this particular year, it is the very rare rookie who actually contributes to winning basketball. I mean, and you look at it, for example, I didn't look at this recently, but the first couple of months of the season last year, right, I think there was one rookie who had a usage rate over 20%, right? And that tells you something, that just teams are not going to go to rookies on offense, and rookies are usually better on offense than they are on defense when they'll really struggle, especially big. So if you expect a rookie to make a difference for your team next year, it probably is not going to happen. And also, we analyze a lot of these guys on the basis of fit, and that may not be the best idea, because it doesn't really matter what these guys are next year. It matters what they are probably even 3-4 years down the road, and who knows what your team is going to look like. And analyzing on fit is the easiest thing to say, because it's a lot easier to talk about how a certain guy in his reputed skill set fits in with the players that are already there that we already know really well. It's a lot harder to say whether this guy is going to be any good or not, and nobody really knows, frankly. So that's, I don't mean to bang on the guys who talk about that. I'm sure we'll talk about it too, but it doesn't matter, I think, nearly as much. And that's why I think the best player available approach in nearly all circumstances is the way to go.
Yeah. And the other component of that, you talked about the idea of that they're not going to contribute right away, is that you don't really need to evaluate on that basis at that much, because you're not going to be looking to those guys to contribute. So you look, I'm very fine with, and it's part of the reason I've had some more unusual picks in my history, guys like Rudy Gobert and Giannis, I had them higher than most. It's because there are a lot of guys that are going to wash out that aren't going to be super great. And so I am a big fan of ceiling, and I think we'll talk a lot about that in this draft. That doesn't mean it's everything, but it's an important part, because it's going to be a little while. And as you said, you don't want to think about the team as they are now, because these guys aren't mostly, at least, going to be relevant now. You look 3 to 4 years from now, but we can't predict that far out, especially not with the new landscape in terms of, I think there are going to be a massive amount of players that change teams in the next couple of years.
So what we're going to do ultimately is we'll go through every pick in the first round and then hit some notable second rounders. But were there any large themes that you took away from this draft as far as what type of player is becoming more valuable, or, just the general value of some of these picks?
I was actually surprised at that. It's not like an overall theme, but that all three Duke guys fell further than expected. I thought that was interesting, because I liked all of them as prospects. It wasn't like, this guy's overhyped because he was on the national championship team. But overall, I didn't think there were that many just what I would call paradigm shifts or huge mistakes or anything. I think there were just some guys that went a little bit higher than I thought they would, and some guys who went a little bit farther, deeper than I thought they would. And, that always happens.
Well, I thought one thing that made an impression on me, number one, is the emphasis that NBA teams are placing on intangibles these days.
Oh, good point.
We saw guys like Cliff Alexander, who, if you remember, just a year ago was a top five recruit, went to Kansas, did not have that great of a year, came off the bench, then ended up getting dismissed from the team due to potential extra benefits situations, didn't have a lot of great stuff to say about Kansas after he left, apparently. Another guy would be Christian Wood out of UNLV, really, really physically talented, killed Arizona when they upset him, or when they upset them during the year, but reportedly did not interview particularly well, and also might have had some red flags in his background. Robert Upshaw, another really, really talented shot blocker type, leaving Washington during the middle of the year. Aaron Harrison, not someone who I thought was in the talent class of those other guys, but another kind of reputedly difficult guy, did not get drafted. All four of those guys. So I think especially with Alexander and Wood and Upshaw, I mean, those are guys who are, I think, clearly first round, at least early second round talents who just teams decided they don't want to deal with these type of guys anymore. And I think they've seen the success that teams like Golden State have had focusing exclusively on high character guys, the Spurs as well. And it's just not worth it with these type of guys. I think they feel like just even if they have the talent, it's just not going to work out with them.
Yeah, Upshaw's a guy that I knew a little bit better because he played at Washington. I'm a West Coast guy. And the stat that really stands out with him, he only played 19 games this year, but he blocked 7 shots per 40 minutes, which is eye-popping. And he was a good rebounder, too. So when you think about a guy who, yeah, I mean, you can talk about where the league is moving in terms of centers, but he's a guy who, if everything else was together, he can protect the rim and he can rebound. And there's a value for that whether a guy starts or comes off the bench. And to not even take him in the top 60 is telling. I think that's a good way of putting it. And I do think that those people will get a shot, but it might be a very different one than they would have gotten even 2-3 years ago.
Now, far be it for me to say that I would have taken a chance on any of these guys, and we should probably stop talking about them soon because it's not really about them this night. But I think they had enough talent that I would have taken a flyer on them, but on the other hand, I don't even really know half the guys in the second round that they were passed over, so I can't really say that those guys are better than the guys who actually were drafted. But just given where some of these guys were and what their physical tools were, and Cliff Alexander especially, I mean, if he just like got into a coffin for a year and got out of it being a top 5 recruit, like you'd think he could at least get drafted, you know? But anyway, another theme that popped out to me was that I think the value that these picks have in this new collective bargaining agreement era, and then also even with the cap going up, the draft pick rookie scale does not rise with the cap. And so rookie scale contracts are all the more valuable. And I think that was reflected perhaps in the few amount of trades that we saw this year in comparison to past years.
Yeah, I agree with that. And what made this year so different is that there were trades with those picks, though there were less, and the ones that were made were shocking.
I was really surprised at the Bucks, that they valued Grievous Vasquez more than they valued $6 million in cap space. And number two, that they would then pay a first-round protected pick in 2017, lottery-protected, for the privilege of getting Vasquez. So that was really surprising to me. And then same thing, Tim Hardaway Jr., for the 19th pick, he actually makes less than what the 19th pick would, I believe. But the Hawks decided they would rather have Tim Hardaway Jr. than that 19th pick, which is also surprising to me, given that Hardaway can't play any defense, and he's only cost-controlled for 2 more years instead of 4, as the 19th pick would have been, which ended up being Jerian Grant.
And then the other pick that was traded during this draft was the 23 pick, when we're talking first-rounders, and that was traded for Mason Plumlee, who is a far more established player than Tim Hardaway Jr.
Yeah, although to hear the reporting, it seemed like Portland originally wanted to keep him, and then they were kind of bowled over by this offer from the Nets. At least that's how it kind of seemed with Woj's reporting. You don't know whether that's true or not, or a smoke screen or whatever, but maybe that's why the offer had to be upped. I happen to really like Rondé, and we'll get to him. So anything else in like a grandiose theme perspective before we just go through these guys and get into it?
No, I the only thing I'll say, we'll get into this, is that almost all the teams I thought did really well in the draft, other than the Raptors, did so because shocking guys fell to them. But that's the way it goes.
Yeah, no, I guess that's the case. So Minnesota, there was little intrigue left. They did, in fact, go for Karl Towns. That had pretty much been assumed. There had been some reports early in the process that Flip Saunders was enamored of Okafor, but those seemed to have dissipated by the time things came around. And I think Karl Towns has a chance to be a top 10 player in the league with his shooting. We've talked about him on past podcasts. The fact that he is a center that he can, I think, is going to be able to shoot the NBA three in relatively short order. Pretty good moving his feet, can block some shots, and I also think is someone who has a nice touch around the rim. He's got left and right hand, and should be able to score. Maybe not a dominant low post scorer ultimately, but certainly someone who can either is going to be able to punish anyone in the post who can also guard him at the 3-point line.
Yeah, I mean, Towns to me was clear-cut the best player in this draft. You think about his ceiling and his floor, his ceiling is really, really high. I mean, it's not, you know, like Anthony Davis, where it's not in that, to me, in that tier, but a group below where he can be a difference maker on both ends. And he's very adaptive because he has a nice jump shot, but as you said, he has a nice touch around the rim, and he does what you need a center to do in the league. So it's not like you're sacrificing that traditional benefit for this unconventional thing. He brings both parts.
Yeah. Now, of course, when we talk about Minnesota, I think early on, I expect to be very frustrated with how he's used. you know, if they try and play him a power forward alongside Pekovic or alongside Gorgui Dieng, I think that's just not using him properly. I think as a center, that's where his shooting becomes so valuable. And especially you also, when you think about some of the post-up guards that they have. I mean, you know, they got plenty of time to figure it out and get the right supporting pieces around them. But I do expect to kind of be banging my head against the wall at how Towns is used early on. And it's also concerning because Flip didn't want Anthony Bennett shooting threes. He didn't really want Wiggins shooting threes. And that's what's going to make Karl Towns so good is the fact that he can shoot threes. So if he ends up just not shooting threes and it's just in the low post, used totally uncreatively, that's going to really upset me with Minnesota. But we are getting ahead of ourselves. Maybe Flip will see the light there, and maybe the reason Anthony Bennett couldn't shoot threes is because he couldn't make them. But let's get on to L.A. Do you think that this is the right pick, or would you have gone with Okafor?
I would have gone with Okafor, but I can see a rationale for Russell. I don't agree with it, but I can see it. And my support of Russell is very different than other people, which is why I'm intrigued by him. And so for me, people talk about how he's a point guard. I think that his intense value is not only defensively, is he a two, not a one from everything I've seen, but he has something that I like in Dante Exum too, which is that he can play on the ball and he can play off the ball. And if you can do that from a shooting guard defensively, that's really valuable, because what that means is that you can get a lot of different point guards. You know, you can get more of an Eric Bledsoe type. You can get more of a traditional, you know, if you want to say, quote-unquote, Steve Nash type. And he can work with both those. He's a talented offensive player. He can do that, and you don't have to worry as much about any defensive misgivings that you could have by having him on ones, because I just don't think he could handle that.
I do agree with you that he's going to be horrendous defensively and worse on ones than he would be on twos, although, you know, I don't see him chasing around a J.J. Redick type particularly well either. But, yeah, not someone who's a high-effort guy at this point, not someone who gets over screens well. You know, putting him in 45 pick-and-rolls a game, I think, would be a complete disaster. I expect the Lakers, assuming that they start him, I mean, think of this lineup, right, that they're going to have. They're going to have Kobe, him, Jordan Clarkson, and then who knows what at the big positions. But none of those guys is going to be able to guard anybody and on the perimeter. So unless they get DeAndre Jordan in free agency, it's hard to imagine. I mean, I think their defense can be just as bad as it was last year.
It might actually be worse.
No matter who they get. I'm sorry?
It might be worse.
Yeah, no, it's not entirely impossible, as Ralph Wiggum would say. But so why do you think, I mean, Philly was right afterwards with him. Why do you think Okafor should have been the pick rather than Russell?
I see Okafor is so immensely talented, and what he does well, I think, will translate pretty well to the NBA game. He's a very nice passer as a back-to-the-basket big. And something you talked about with Mike Schmitz in a podcast I liked a lot is that I feel like his defensive problems are much more correctable. They're not, I don't think he's ever going to be a plus-plus defender or anything like that, but if he can get to passable, if he can get to league average, those are different stages, he becomes a much more valuable player. And I feel like that's entirely possible. His free throw shooting is concerning, but his touch around the basket is incredible. And I like what he can do And it's one of those things that if you can do something at an elite level, I think you can succeed in the NBA. And what I've seen of him, I think he can do some of that at the NBA level.
Like you, I understand the rationale for Russell, but think that Okafor will be better. Russell has, I think, maybe even a higher ceiling than Towns, potentially. But there are a lot of questions that have to be answered. Number one is his shooting 40% from three? Is that for real? On contested jump shots, he actually shot much, much better on contested threes than non-contested threes, which would give you an idea that maybe that those numbers aren't necessarily to be trusted, and it takes a lot of threes before you really know what someone is. Not a great free throw shooter the way you would expect a really, truly awesome shooter to be. His passing is beyond reproach. He's an unbelievable passer. He has soccer-style vision. I mean, the type of stuff that he sees is fantastic. I mean, he'll throw these soccer-style passes just out in space to guys for them to kind of run onto. It's really just, you know, a remarkable skill he has. He's probably the best passer to come out in like 5 years, I would say. But is also really below, I would say below average for his height in the NBA athletically. Really struggles to finish at the rim. No right hand. No real moves finishing at the rim. He has like a floater that's not very good or a left-hand layup. That's basically it. And also he can't go right to the basket at all. It's always a jumper if he goes right. And he can't pass right-handed either. So he really has a lot. Like that's like four or five questions I just listed off. The answer to all of those is going to have to be in the affirmative for him to really reach his potential as a fantastic player. And, you know, it's a long way to go. So I totally understand why on ESPN in their new formula, there was a little bit of a question about, you know, whether this guy has a little bit higher of a potential to kind of bust out. I don't think he's ever going to totally bust out because he's long and he can pass the ball. And there's also big questions about his overall level of competitiveness in the floor game that really bother me. You know, not a guy who's going to hustle, not a guy who's going to get loose balls, not going to inspire you with effort plays. So, yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of question marks there, even though the ceiling is extremely high. And I feel a little bit better about Okafor reaching what he can be because his questions aren't as big to me or as many.
Yeah, for me, I didn't end up having Russell third. I think I ended up with him fourth. But what's a way for me to phrase it is that I thought he was a lot closer to the pack than he was to the top, even if you have him in this group. Like, even if I had him third, because his flaws are concerning, and they're the type of thing that you couldn't be sure weren't going to be a problem. It's not one of those things you can explain away. I think back to that Arizona game in the tournament, you know, like when Ohio State didn't play a ton of great NBA teams with NBA talent, particularly on the perimeter, just the structure of their schedule and who they faced. And that's always a concern when a guy doesn't do it against that kind of competition. And that doesn't mean he can't. It just means you're going on a very different sample.
Yeah, so we've beaten Okafor to death in some of these previous podcasts, but I do think he's going to be very likely will be the rookie of the year if he stays healthy, considering the lack of other offensive options in Philly. I think, you know, he clearly was the best guy left on the board. You have to take him, despite the fact that you have these other two basically centers. I mean, Noel is a center, offensively at least. He can play power forward just fine defensively once he, you know, kind of gets his head around NBA defense. And, you know, Embiid, who knows what the deal is with him now, with him potentially getting more opinions on that foot. But I think also, even if they do have all three of those guys in the rotation, it'll be good for Okafor and good for all of them, Embiid too, that, you know, if they can't just slack off on D and they're going to have to work. I mean, I think that's the biggest thing, that Okafor is going to need some incentive to work. I mean, you can, you know, if you're going to play all those three of those guys, it's not going to be perfect together, but, you know, especially with the complete lack of outside shooting they have in their roster as well. But I do think at least that Philly has a lot of athletes on the perimeter, and they will probably bring in at least some more too, to where, and Brett Brown is a nice defensive system. So I think that can at least help him to get better defensively, regardless of whether there's a fit there or not. So I think that's good. Now we get to Porzingis. Kind of, I would say, the first controversial pick here? Would you say that?
Yeah, I mean, you could talk about with Russell, but Porzingis is the first, let's say divisive. I think divisive is a good word for it. And I'll talk first on Porzingis, if you don't mind. Well, I had trouble articulating it for Real GM. I wrote a piece the day before the draft, and what I decided on is that I don't think Porzingis has the connective tissue in terms of his, particularly his offensive game, to be a dominant NBA player. I mean, you heard some lofty comparisons thrown out there. I'm not going to give voice to them. But the problem with that is that if you're a good shooter, and we've seen this with a guy like Klay Thompson, you need to bring more than that to be a real, complex, valuable offensive player. You know, whether it's cutting ability, whether it's ball handling, passing. And that concerns me a lot with him, because if you can't do those things, you're going to have to be so good at what you're good at to be this kind of a value.
So this is my problem with him. I would have gotten Moutier here. He actually was third on my board. I think I had Russell fourth. And the reason why is I think he has some very severe weaknesses that I don't know are going to improve. The strength thing actually bothers me the least out of them. I mean, that's one thing he is going to have to improve, but I think that's something you can improve. Number one, to me, he's slow. Slow for an NBA four, if he's going to play the four, he's slow compared to most NBA fours. You know, the idea of him putting the ball on the floor and getting to the basket or doing any type of isolations and shaking guys off the dribble, not going to happen for a long time unless he significantly improves his quickness. Number two, not really that good of a leaper. He's not very quick off the ground. He'll make some plays that you can make if you can jump because he has this incredible 7'6 wingspan. But people who talk about him as athletic, I just don't see it. I mean, I may be in the minority there, but, you know, he's got the long arms, but he's not quick, and he's not really a quick jumper, and he doesn't really get up that high either. So there's that. And then also just a lack of feel, both defensively as far as helping out, his foot speed as well defensively, trying to protect the rim and also get out to shooters. I mean, Zach Lowe had a good question that he asked of Chad Ford on his podcast the other day, which was, why am I not going to just put a wing on him? And Chad Ford said, well, you know, you can shoot the ball over him, which, you know, that's a good point. You know, he will be able to do that even on the perimeter, but I think whatever he gains from that, he's going to give up on the other end just due to his lack of quickness. And then you throw in that he doesn't have the awareness. He's also just a miserable passer. Only had, you know, less than 30 assists in 50 games last year. And, you know, and also turned the ball over quite a bit. Once you get to there, I don't see it with him. And I will give Phil Jackson credit because he is taking the long view. Porzingis, not someone I think who anyone thinks is going to help right away. And we thought that he might go way short term with where Carmelo is, just his own age and just the overall pressure. I think I respect the fact that he is taking the long view, but I wouldn't have done it in this manner.
Yeah, it was funny to me that you started with the physical limitations and I started with the basketball limitations, just because that makes him so much scarier, is that there are flaws on both sides. Like, for me, his passing is horrifying. I mean, he had, what, 26 assists this year? I mean, that's...
Yeah, and a 25% usage rate, too. So he's shooting the ball quite a bit. Yeah, I mean, and, you know, his shooting is very good. And maybe if he learns to post up and punish guys and gets a lot stronger in a few years, I might look like an idiot. But yet again, another guy who, like Russell, I feel like, yeah, he's got some tools. And but at least Russell, you know, he's a baller and he's got like the basketball IQ. I mean, Porzingis loves to work, but you know, he just seems like one of these guys, stereotype or no, unfortunately, who is probably better in an empty gym than he is actually playing out there. We'll see. I mean, you know, I'm not saying he won't be good. I just think, to me, with the fact that some of his physical limitations and the mental limitations, I would have had him more kind of in the 6 to 10 range than as a guaranteed top five type of guy.
Yeah. Only other thing I'll add is that we talked about how he might not be able to defend fours. It's not like you can play him at the five because he can't rebound. He's not a great rebounder. He's not a reliable rim protector. So it's not like you can move him up a position and you'll be okay.
That, to me, is his most possible way towards success, is if he can bulk up a little bit more to play the five, because then his speed limitations won't be as much of an issue. He certainly has the height and the length to play the five.
Sure.
And even the shot blocking ability when the play is right in front of him. So it's just a question of whether he can be athletic enough. He's also terrible on the defensive glass. That's probably more a function of the strength. I don't think he has the greatest hands even either. And he does have the ability to play in pick and roll. So maybe that's ultimately how he becomes a really valuable player, but I don't see him as being a good enough scorer or having the potential scoring upside to where you want to jump all over him with the fourth pick. But we'll see. I could be wrong. There's a lot of people who love him, so I recognize that I'm in the minority here.
We're both in the minority here.
Mario Hezonja, for the Magic, your thoughts on this one? He's the one guy really in the top seven or eight that I did not watch a ton of film of. I have the understanding of what he's supposed to be. What are your thoughts on Orlando going for him?
So I'm of two minds with it. One is I really like Hezonja. He fits. He's one of these guys. I have this long-standing thing that I don't like swingmen who I don't think are going to be number one scorers or lead defenders. He's neither of those probably. But he has a lot of talent, and I just see him as being like the third or fourth best player on a great team. Like, I just see that as his destiny. And that's not a bad thing. You know, that's a really good role. Maybe even second if he pushes it. The problem with it is that Emmanuel Mudiay was on the board. And Hezonja, I like him a lot.
But they already have Elfrid Payton. Elfrid Payton is the next great point guard in Orlando. According to them. Don't feel that way. You might guess from my slight amount of sarcasm, I don't necessarily either.
It's another one of those examples about how you take the BPA regardless of fit, because Payton has some selling points, but I just feel like his ceiling is too low to pass on a superior talent. You know, like, there are certain guys who, you know, maybe especially if they're on the edges, because you can't really slide guys if, you know, edges meaning point guard and center. Mudiay has so much more potential to be that guy, like to be a difference-making point guard, or at the very least to be an above-average point guard. And there's an intense value to that. I think that people underappreciate what being a top 15 point guard is in this league, and he could be better than that. And the other benefit that Mudiay has that Payton does not is that I feel like you could slide him defensively to the two if you needed to in situations, and so then if he doesn't develop necessarily in the same way that you want him to, at least you have more flexibility in terms of what you do with him. So that makes him to me an even more valuable player. I think we both had him at third overall, so I like Hezonja. If the Knicks had taken Mudiay, I would be much more enthusiastic about my support with this pick, and I think he'll be a lot of fun. He fits a lot of the weaknesses that Orlando has, though I think fit matters less. But Mudiay, this was another pick where it's like, he's right there, guys. Just take him. Just take him. And they didn't do it.
Well, Mike Schmidt said he has had him third on his board. I said I was going to watch more film of him. I didn't actually have time to on the podcast. And I don't know that I quite see it as much with him because the lack of an in-between game. I think the J.R. Smith comparison is a pretty good one for him. Frankly, he might end up being a little better defender than JR, but as far as like a guy who can get into the rim and maybe dunk on you or get out in transition and then will just bomb from the 3-point line, but, you know, not a guy that I see, and also like maybe even an underrated passer as well, Hezonja. But yeah, and I also think, you know, they need somebody long term who's going to be able to shoot the ball on the wing, so I understand that as well. I mean, that they really see Oladipo and Payton. I mean, Payton just can't shoot. That's the problem, right? Like, and you've already got Aaron Gordon. I mean, I think Mudiay is not a great shooter, but he's someone who at least projects to get to average. I mean, Payton is, I mean, if he ever hits a three-pointer and, becomes even above a 30% three-point shooter on a decent volume, I would be surprised. So, that is a front office that I've never really, my talent evaluations just haven't agreed with them. And, you know, I guess we'll see who ends up being right. I mean, I didn't think that Aaron Gordon over Exum was necessarily the right pick last year. I didn't think that giving Vucevic the big extension was necessarily a great idea, or playing Channing Frye at the four instead of the five, or, you know, quite a few other things. And I think, you know, Payton was a good pick at 10 for what he's been, but also, you know, not someone who's so good because of the lack of shooting that I think you can really, like, you know, pass on somebody else for a player I don't think is going to be quite as good. So, but again, I didn't see enough of Hezonja. I should probably stop talking, frankly, because he might end up being really, really awesome. He didn't quite pop out that way to me. But, you know, again, maybe if I'd watch more of him, I'd feel differently.
I didn't watch a ton of him in the last year, but I actually, because I'm somebody who really likes looking at draft-eligible guys, regardless of whether they declare, I really liked him when he was younger, because, and I made the J.R. Smith comparison actually back in, I wasn't the first one by any stretch of the imagination, in November of 2013, and I'm somebody who really liked J.R. Smith as a prospect. So this isn't like, oh, you know, he's a head case or anything like that. I liked him a lot, and what he brings in the right circumstance, and I think we saw that with JR, is that he can bring energy and he brings a kind of a swagger, and he has so much self-belief that it can be a problem, but it can also work in the right system. The weird parallel in terms of that emotional range with that is Draymond Green. I think that he's a guy who has that similar thing. It wouldn't work everywhere, just like Draymond Green barking at the guys when he was a second-round pick wouldn't have worked everywhere. But I think that could work in Orlando, but we've talked enough about that. We've talked about a lot of guys we agree on. We agree broadly on this pick, but the Willie Cauley-Stein, DeMarcus Cousins combination is something that we've disagreed on before.
Yeah. They're not going to be able to score with those two guys.
Nope. I don't care.
So you agree with, I mean,
I agree with you on that. I like the way Seth Partnow put it on Twitter. It might be a step back on offense. I just think it's two steps forward on defense. I am not saying it's going to be slam dunk. I'm saying that I think that their strengths and weaknesses defensively complement one another well enough that will be worth it. And if it fails, I think that both of them have a ton of value.
I actually think they have a bigger weakness offensively.
That's fair.
And I think, I mean, if it were me, my style, and this is basically the exact opposite, my style would be Cousins at center, and then you get another 3-and-D guy, and you switch everything on the perimeter, and you got four shooters, or at least perimeter guys, around Cousins to really maximize what he can do posting up. Playing Cauley-Stein with him, you know, if you think that, like, Cousins had no space before, now he's really going to have no space, and his efficiency is really going to suffer. He's going to have to take a lot of mid-rangers, a lot of tough post-up shots. So I'm really worried about that. And then, so let's say now, and the other thing too is this. If Willie Cauley-Stein is out there playing the four on offense, why am I not going to just guard him with a wing? He can't do anything to hurt that. And now you've got Willie Cauley-Stein. Yeah, I mean, he's pretty good out in the perimeter. Don't get me wrong. He can block some shots, but you know, for a guy his size, he's supposed to have incredible speed, and he does from the film that I've seen. But, you know, you're still, I don't think you're going to win that battle of him versus a wing guy when he cannot hurt the wing guy at all on the other end. And you also have a wing guy guarding him. Then when you're double teaming, you're a lot faster getting back to your man. He's not really an amazing rebounder either, so I don't think he's going to hurt too badly on that strategy too badly on the glass. And, you know, we talk about fit, you know, not drafting for fit, but Cousins, theoretically, is someone who's going to be there for a very long time and is one of the best players in the league. So that's maybe the one time that I go away from that. And then also, you know, they had Moutier still on the board, who I think is just going to be a much better player than Cauley-Stein overall. The problem there, though, and Vlade Divac said this in an interview afterwards, I can't remember where I saw it in passing on Twitter, was he didn't work out there, and so right. They weren't really comfortable drafting him. I'm sure, you know, Vlade Divac wasn't even the decision maker, you know, back when he was in China. So I'm sure he never saw him in China. Only Hinkie was the only one who went. So you're just looking at him on film, and you know, Vlade wasn't at like the 2014 Hoop Summit either. So really, like, you know, I think they just didn't have the level of being comfortable enough, which is a shame because I think Moutier in the long term would have been exactly what the doctor ordered for this franchise.
Yeah, and that's the part that I wanted to get to with this, is that while we disagree on the fit with Cousins and Cauley-Stein, we completely agree that they should have taken Moutier. And I understand the uncomfortability they had with that, but I think that's why you have a full scouting staff And something that was interesting to me during the conversations with Moutier is that it's true that he went to China and has that, but he was a high school player in the United States and was heavily scouted. He also played in a lot of, as you said, like the Hoop Summit and those things. So it was possible to have an informed opinion on Emmanuel Moutier. It was not this, you're looking at Grady Finnish like Skidichvili back in the day. There was that capability. And so it's disappointing, especially if there's a rumor that they're interested in Rajon Rondo, where you're talking about Cousins and spacing, that annihilates it even more. Lawson's a little bit different if they do that, but Moutier would have been great there. It's very disappointing, but I feel like we can move on because...
Hold on, though. I went on at length about why I think Cauley Stein is a bad fit. Why do you think he's a good fit? I think, like, people... want to know that.
Okay.
Completely unsuccessfully to convince me here.
Oh, I'm not going to convince you. Okay, so I think that Cousins' biggest weakness is defensively is in the pick and roll. I think that he's a good defensive rebounder. I actually like him as a man-to-man defender. You know, not great, obviously, but I think that he's all right there. And Cauley Stein is so versatile and so flexible in those circumstances that I think that you can use the way that a team structures their offense against them with a guy like Cauley Stein. So, you know, if you have one big man who's primarily the screener, then you can do a lot of stuff with Cauley Stein on him. And so in certain teams, that might mean switching them between who guards the power forward, who guards the center. But I think that I like guys who have different strengths and different weaknesses, and I think that they can do that. You also mentioned, and it's true, that Cauley Stein is not the best defensive rebounder. You know who's a really good defensive rebounder? DeMarcus Cousins. And so I feel like they will work against a lot of combinations. You are right that some teams will want to put a wing on it, but there are a lot of really good power forwards. There are a lot of really good power forwards in the West. You're not going to see wherever LaMarcus Aldridge ends up, you're not going to see them sit LaMarcus Aldridge because they want to put a wing on Willie Cauley Stein. I don't think he's good enough offense or bad enough or whatever to do the needle that way, but he can negate a positive the other way. And there are a lot of positive power forwards in this league, a lot of positive centers that I feel like he can give them an advantage on. I'm not saying he's going to set the world on fire. I'm not saying he's the perfect fit. I'm saying that there will be ways that it will work, especially for me, if they ever made the playoffs in a playoff series, that would be notable positives that you wouldn't get from really any other human being.
All right. I see your point there. I think that whatever he's going to add defensively, I think the impact is a lot lower if he's not playing center, and also just even if it is a pretty good impact, that's taken away from what he's going to hurt on offense, both that he himself can't score and then what he takes away from Cousins. But another thing that we should note with him too, kind of considered to be a little bit of a quirky guy. You know, we don't know where that falls on the Robin Lopez to Royce White spectrum. You know, I've never talked to him before. I don't know, but that's just what people say. And then also reputed to have potentially this issue still with his ankle where someone said it was only 50% healed. The pin that was inserted is supposed to be at a 90-degree angle, and instead it's at a 45-degree angle. His camp says, no, like he doesn't have any pain. It's fine, not an issue. But that's another thing that maybe, you know, could come back to be an issue. Let's get to Moutier. Denver's got to be doing backflips that they got him.
Yep. I think I put that exact phrase in my recap, which just shows that I'm very comfortable using hackneyed cliches. But it's true. Moutier, I mean, we both had him third. He's a great talent. I think he's a guy who distinctly has the possibility of being very, very good. Maybe not great in that sense. I mean, the great standard of point guard is quite high right now. But he can do a lot. He's a very good player, and he does it at an important position. I mean, I think he's going to be successful running an NBA offense, and to get him at 7, especially in a draft where we had so many concerns, while they're good, we had concerns about the guys after the first pick. To get a guy like that at 7 is just fabulous.
To me, he actually has either the second or third highest floor in this draft because he's athletic, very good passer, should be able to get to being a pretty good finisher in time. He's a true point guard at 6'5". Point guard handle, point guard vision. Will be able to guard the one and the two, no problem. And the one question mark is the free throw shooting and the outside jumper. But even if that never really comes around too much, you know, I think he could certainly still be an average type of point guard. And if the shooting comes around, someone who could even, he doesn't quite have the nuclear athleticism where I think he'll be a real, like, top five point guard in the league, but I think he could settle into that 5 to 10 range very easily. And not that much has to go right for him to get to that. And also a guy who I think everyone says is a leader and a high character guy and a worker. So, and I think what he did in China, it's weird to say that he has a high floor when he went to China, but he managed to succeed in a professional league, and I think that deserves some credit too.
Absolutely, and he did it with the right mindset. I mean, he didn't do it, just as a money making opportunity. He did it as a way to, to grow his game and to do all that. And it seems like he behaved himself and everything like that over there. It's a shame. I mean, to me, the best tweet of the draft was you talking about how he hurt. You can paraphrase it if you want, but he hurt his stock by not being an indentured servant for a year and playing in the NCAA. And that is true. And I mean, we saw that with other guys too. And I think that he would have gone much higher, maybe even number two, if teams had been able to see him more regularly and seen his athleticism against college players.
Yeah, and John Gavoni of Draft Express had a good point that if he had worked out lower than four, maybe he would have gotten picked by Sacramento or maybe even possibly Orlando. I mean, I think maybe he didn't want to go there just because Peyton and Oladipo are already there. But anyway, I mean, not like an incredibly precipitous fall. And I think with some of the talent that Denver has in place and, Mike Malone, not a huge running guy, but I think maybe he'll do that more now that he's in Denver. Moutier could really make an impact, especially since it's starting to look very much like Denver is going to move on from Ty Lawson.
Can I say one quick thing? I'm very intrigued by the possibility of a 1-4 pick and roll with Moutier and Gallinari.
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, he can find Fareed on alley-oops. Yusuf Nurkic, also a pretty good pick and roll guy. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what he can do with those guys. I mean, I think he's also even someone who can switch pretty well if he's defending the point guard position, and they'll have some guys, whether it's Fareed, who hopefully will get better at that. He has the athleticism. I hope he will. Even Nurkic is a guy who can switch out late clock and has surprisingly quick feet. So, I like the fit with him there. Stanley Johnson over Justice Winslow in Detroit. I was not as up in arms in this about this as some people were. I think that Stanley actually looked like a much better prospect as recently as the Hoop Summit when I saw all of them in 2014. Justice passed him, I think, perhaps rightfully so, but I think that Stanley doesn't really have any weaknesses to me other than a lack of elite explosion and finishing at the rim. I think he's really improved his shot. He's got like a nice hop, quick release now, which he didn't have. He's someone who works pretty hard in the gym. And also I really like him, which Justice is not going to be able to do because he's an excellent rebounder, great hands, and he weighs 245. So can easily, I think, in time play the four position, will be able to shoot from that position, defend most post-up fours. And, I really like the versatility that he brings, and Detroit needed a true three in the long term, and I think that they got one.
Yeah, I think that at first I was a little bit more frustrated with it, and what I realized is it took me a second to think about it, and it's like I wasn't as high on Justice Winslow as a lot of other people were. He's definitely has the potential to be a good player, and he deserves credit for how much he improved since he was even his high school years, but it's even during his year at Duke. But Stanley Johnson should be a good NBA player, and I can see the case for it. Stan Van Gundy, I'm sure he saw plenty of both of them, so it's not an issue of, took the guy you know over the guy you don't know. And I would have taken Justice, but at first I was frustrated by it, but as I thought about it more, I'm like, I disagree. It's one of those, I disagree with it, but I can see the other side, as opposed to some of the ones we'll get to later where it's like, you just messed up.
Do you believe that one of those is Charlotte taking Kaminsky over Justice at 9?
Yes, but I like Kaminsky more than you do, but Kaminsky he's a nice player, but Justice Winslow can be a long-time starter in the league. I think that Kaminsky has his ceiling is to be, like an interesting NBA starter. I think it's a lot more likely that Winslow gets there. and his defensive potential, meaning Justice's, not Frank's, is at a level where I think that that could be a surplus value. I like Kaminsky a lot. I even think I had them really close in my board, not that my board is the gospel or anything like that. But Justice is a really good basketball player, and they could have done a lot with that. And while Kaminsky has potential, I like him. I like him particularly because his handle. I talked about how Porzingis doesn't have the connective tissue offensively. I think Kaminsky does, which is nice. But he has some flaws defensively, and you'll get into that a little bit, that make him shaky in terms of whether he can start. But offensively, I like his game a lot. There's a lot to like there. He's not going to be dominant in that sense. You know, he's not going to be able to do the things to pro players, especially at the four, that he was able to do to college players, because the pro fours have seen a lot of that before. But he's still a really talented player.
I think he's a five defensively. And I think he can play the four in the sense that he can shoot. And so anybody who can shoot can kind of play more outside offensively. But I don't think his dribble drive game is going to work in the NBA. I think that's too slow. I don't think that he's going to be necessarily strong enough to post up unless it's a mismatch. I don't think he can post up very effectively against centers. And even if he is a center defensively, not someone who really protects the rim that well. Mike Schmidt, interestingly, said that he thinks that Kaminsky can guard the four. I am not sure that I agree with him, especially in the sense of, even if he can one-on-one, his ability to actually close out to the three-point line is pretty suspect. And now Charlotte, I mean, they've got Cody Zeller, they've got Kaminsky, they've got Spencer Hawes, and they've got Al Jefferson. Maybe Al Jefferson is not a part of the long-term plans. But yeah, I mean, it's not really, this seems like another one, kind of one of these like Michael Jordan picks. Like to me, like, I don't think Kaminsky is not an NBA player by any means, but I think he's more likely going to be sort of a 15-20 minute a game center off the bench, who's not going to be able to hold up defensively against starters.
Yeah, and I think that, like, we talked about the idea of a role. Like, Justice Winslow, to me, he doesn't have a super high floor, but it would be surprising to me if he wasn't a useful rotation player. You know, like, he's a guy who I can see his place in the league. I can see what he can do well. Kaminsky's washout proportion, it seems much higher to me.
Yeah, so let's get to Miami now. We'll try and pick up the pace a little bit more here. Really, I think they're doing backflips that they got him. I will not be saying that term again, hopefully, but seem to fall into it a little bit. And he's a real competitor, fits in fantastically with their culture. They desperately needed some athleticism on the wing. It'll be interesting to see what ends up happening with Luol Deng now if they have him. I think he actually is someone who can help a little bit. He might be able to play 20 minutes a game effectively for them. I wouldn't say that about that many rookies contributing to a team that's actually serious about winning, but I think he could play 20 minutes a game for them. Hopefully, I don't see him being able to shoot the NBA three right away. But, you know, I think he can just, with what he does in the floor game, that he can find a way to be effective in those minutes. But, yeah, just getting a guy like him, a guy who improves a ton, as you noted, I think he can get there at least with his standstill three. And he's got some nice herky-jerky moves getting to the rim. And I think he can improve his explosiveness even a little bit more, too. I think from a value perspective, they're just about the happiest of anybody right now, based on that. So I think we've said enough about him, especially in previous.
Well, can I say one thing?
Yeah,
he gets a huge benefit offensively by being able to play with guys who are going to be higher on the totem pole. I'm so happy for him that he can be the third, fourth, or fifth option on a team this early, because that will help him so much, as opposed to same kind of thing as with a couple of guys. And so him falling, I think, helps him so much, because depending on who they bring back, but I assume Dragic, probably Wade, who knows, that's going to help him so much because they have Bosch too. I mean, they have a lot of good offensive players.
Miles Turner to Indy, basically kind of like Kevin Pelton, I think, put it best when he said that it enables them to play with the same rim protection that they had with Hibbert ultimately, but then get some more spacing. I think they've talked about wanting to run more. Turner famously doesn't run very well. He's been working with trainers to fix that. And, you know, I don't think he's ever really going to be, you know, a terror in transition, but he can at least probably end up being faster than Roy has been. But the nice thing about him is that hopefully at least he can shoot the ball. So, cause the problem with Roy is not only can he not shoot the ball, but he also lacks the explosiveness to even like finish dump offs inside or catch alley oops. And so he's really just, unless he's posting up, he's pretty much an offensive zero and he kills their spacing. Turner ultimately, I think, can get to the point where he'll shoot NBA threes. He's got a nice touch and he's really an excellent shot blocker. So I think that's a good pick for them. Not someone who's necessarily going to help right away. It looks like David West is gone. It was just a surprise, as Candace Buckner reported yesterday. Maybe going to the Knicks. We'll get into all this player option stuff probably over the weekend. But yeah, I think he's a good pick. Probably the highest upside guy remaining on the board, except for maybe Kelly Oubre.
Yeah, as we talked about a little bit, for me, if you're a center physically, you can block shots and you can rebound at a high level, I'm going to like you. And that's just the way it is, unless you're Robert Upshaw and you have his issues. But I'm a supporter of Robert Upshaw. I like Turner. I like his offensive game relatively. And yeah, he's not a great runner in transition, but now that David West is probably out of the picture, you can get more of a four that can do some of those things. And for me, it's a nice perk to have from a center, but if you can get his shooting range, that's just as nice a perk.
Trey Lyles to Utah. Probably, I think, a player that most assumed would be there. They're talking about hopefully changing him into a stretch four. I think that he can make that transition. And, you know, just seeing him shoot in practice at the Hoop Summit, much has been made of the fact that he shot like, you know, 5 out of 25 or whatever it was on threes at Kentucky, playing out of position at the four. Playing out of position at the three. I think if he's as a backup four, he's also someone who has a good feel for the game. He can post up a little bit if you try and go with a wing on him. I think he can actually hurt people a little bit in the post. So I don't see him being a huge asset right from the start, just with how young he is. But he does weigh 250, and he's got good mobility, good passer. And I think not the highest upside guy, but a very understandable pick if he can develop into something where you're really kind of just looking for a third big ultimately to pair with Favors and with Gobert.
I don't love him. I think that people see more in him than I do, but I do think that there is potential there. I think that his ceiling is about where other people have it. I just think his floor is a lot lower, but I it's not like there was somebody there out there. You know, we're not sitting there with a Winslow who's like, oh my God, they can take him. So, you know, I don't love it, but I'm not going to harp on it forever.
Yeah, I mean, really the only guy that I might have wanted to have instead of him is Cameron Payne. I really like Cameron Payne a lot. Granted, the Jazz already have two point guards in the fold, but neither of them has proven that he can be an adequate NBA offensive player. Granted, those guys are young. I expect that at least one of them, Burke and Exum, will become that. But maybe you take another lottery ticket there, because I do think Payne can ultimately end up being a better player than Lyles. We'll see, though. Phoenix, Devin Booker. What did you think of that pick?
From what I've seen, all he can do is shoot. He's very good at that, like as a catch-and-shoot guy, not even just like a shooter, you know, like do that. But he's very good at that. It's a strange fit for me with, because you talk about that fit, that they've made a pretty serious commitment, it seems like, to Bledsoe and Knight. And if you have both of those guys, Booker's not, you know, there aren't a ton of minutes there, but you don't need a ton from that. I'm fine with it, but I don't love the pick. I'm not the biggest fan of Devin Booker.
This is just another asset obtained by Celtics West. And not surprising since Ryan McDonough started off there. But I think that, you know, if you want to look at the wings of the future, that having him with TJ Warren, having another great shooter, Warren's not a great shooter, but is a scorer, maybe if you get to the point where you've got those two guys playing together on the wing, that could conceivably work out. But again, I mean, I think this is, you know, as you look at this as another asset and see whether he develops or not. He's really, really young, youngest guy in the draft. That's probably the biggest reason to like him. Like you, I think that he is a shooter, but looks pretty one-dimensional and doesn't really quite seem to have like that elite speed coming off of screens, and not, you know, barely even is dunking it. You know, on a fast break. So pretty unathletic, but, you know, can shoot the ball. We'll see whether his great shooting percentage was a function of the looks he got at Kentucky or not. Payne, pretty much talked about him already. I think he fits really well in Oklahoma City as a potential backup. He can also play off the ball pretty well. He came off the screens. He also really moves the ball well, makes a simple pass, which I think is very important when you consider some of the other scorers that they have there. If you think of him as maybe long-term fitting in behind Westbrook as a backup point guard or maybe able to play alongside him. But again, you know, I think just clearly the best talent remaining on the board, at least in my mind. And that's why, you know, he's the right pick regardless of whether Westbrook leaves or Durant leaves. I mean, you know, by the time he becomes a good player, both those guys could be gone. You don't know. So just get the best guy who can help you at some point.
Now, Ed Mason, that's going to hate you as much as he hates me. But McPain, why I like him, you need 48 minutes of guys who can run an offense. He can be one of those guys. I'm not sure he'll be that right away, but he can get there eventually. And as you said, I like that he can play on and off the ball. If you're a guy who's not a clear-cut starter in the league and you can do both those things, you can have a nice career for yourself. And so Oklahoma City, you need guys who can get on the floor, who can contribute. That's a great fit.
Washington traded up with Atlanta. What did they pick up? They got two second-rounders?
Two eventual second-rounders, and I checked, and Washington only has their own, so wherever those are, they're probably not going to be great. You know, they'll probably be in that early 50s range. So they got that to move up, I think it was four picks?
Yeah, from 19 to 15, replacing Atlanta. Kelly Oubre is someone who, when I saw him at the Hoop Summit, I thought he had the most physical potential of any of those class of 2014 wings, guys like Winslow, guys like Stanley Johnson, but not nearly, I don't think, as skilled as those guys at this point. You know, he can make an open three, never goes right at all, ever. You know, another one of these lefties in this draft who doesn't do that. But, you know, a real good jumper, especially off of 1 foot, 7'2" wingspan. Like, he will definitely dunk on you off of 1 foot. And just kind of a guy I think it's good for Washington to have in the pipeline is another guy who could potentially come in, maybe a guy as well who has some potential to play a little bit at the four as he fills out in the small ball lineups that Randy Whitman now all of a sudden loves after the playoffs. So yeah, I mean, I think at 15, getting a guy who could potentially be a high level starter if he gets it, which a lot of people don't think he can, not bad. How about Terry Rozier? I will be very honest with you. I did not know that much about him. I've seen him a few times, both on TV and in person at Adidas Nations last year, and never really popped off the court to me in any setting.
I watched more of him his freshman year when he played with Russ and that the Louisville team. I just was engaged more by that team. I just watched more of Montrezl that year. He's a good defender, maybe even a great defender, but if you're a point guard and I don't trust you to run an offense, it's going to be hard to find find a really successful life in this league. I mean, that's not to say he can't get there. He certainly can eventually, but that is majorly concerning. He also shot, I believe, was 30% from three this year, though he did shoot almost 80% from the line, so maybe you can get better with that, but that's a concern. We talked about that with Elfrid Payton. I really actively didn't like this pick because he's just one of those guys, you know, like, I think he'll make a spot in the league, but there were guys who could do a whole heck of a lot more than that at this pick. And so why take him, especially when I assume he would have been around later. In fact, I think he would have been around by their next pick.
Yeah, I mean, you tweeted that their number 28, R.J. Hunter, you thought would be a better player than Rozier. I really don't know, but I will say, I mean, he's considered a good defender, but not really, you know, point guard size, but not really a good shooter or passer. So
yeah.
when you consider that, and then you also have, you know, Smart and Avery Bradley, again, we're getting into fit. You know, this is just kind of another asset, basically. But was a little interesting. And probably the biggest surprise pick of the draft, at least in the first round.
Yeah, especially considering some of the guys on the board, like Sam Decker and Jerian Grant. I mean, Jerian, I guess, doesn't fit in as well. Or a guy like Bobby Portis, who I would have liked for them, made more sense not only with their talent, but I think most people had as better players. So, yeah, that's. I think it was, off the top of my head, I think it was the weakest pick of the first round.
Rashad Vaughn to Milwaukee. He is the second youngest player in the draft. definitely can shoot it. Not necessarily a pure shooter. Likes to shoot off the dribble. More kind of a gunner type than, you know, a dead pure shooter. But I think that Milwaukee knows that they need this is a team where actually I don't mind as much their drafting for need a little bit, because when you have Giannis and you have Jabari, you're just going to need some more. And you have Michael Carter Williams, all guys who apparently are in their long-term plan. And when you have young guys, it's a little different than if you have guys who could be free agents in a year or two. So I think that that makes sense to get him, you know, I think projects as kind of a bench scorer gunner type with the second unit who can get hot. That's kind of how I see him.
Yeah, I didn't see a ton of Vaughn this year, but that's largely what I've thought about him. And it's the other thing you're talking about, you know, the idea of building around guys for your... I feel like just I want to say a little bit more about how insane it is that they traded our first-round pick for Grievous Vasquez.
Yeah, we will get there, I guess. I guess that's not... Yeah, we can talk about that now.
That's why I was thinking about, because... Yeah. Like, he's an expiring contract who you don't get extra years. This isn't like Mason Plumlee where you're going to get restricted free agency. And he's not underpaid. And he's a backup guard. You're not going to use him as a starter. It's not like he's this, you know, diamond in the rough that nobody's seen it before. And it was honestly the most shocking thing I can think of in the draft in the last like 5 or 6 years. And last year, Bruno Caboclo won in the first round.
Yeah, I mean, there have definitely been a few things. I would not want to make that statement. I'm sure I'm forgetting about a bunch of them. But, yeah, he really, like Vasquez, to me, I would rather sign three guys for $2 million a year than Vasquez just on the hope that you hit on one of them. Because, I mean, Vasquez is just, he's not going to make or break what you're trying to do. And he's so terrible defensively on the perimeter. He has become a better shooter, which helps. Like, that's good. And he does have pretty decent passing vision. But, man, he just does not, you know, maybe he's someone who can close games for them at the point on days that Michael Carter Williams is just killing the offense. But I don't know. I've never really thought that highly of him. I thought he was a little bit overpaid with the contract that he got to re-sign in Toronto. But I understood why they kept him, because they wanted to keep that team together. So, yeah, it's give me $6 million in cap space instead of him, please. And definitely, I would like to keep my first round pick for the privilege of paying him $6 million in cap space for the next year as well.
Yeah, it was, and they gave up a second round pick for him too.
Sam Decker for Houston. Tyus Jones was mocked here for pretty much every mock draft had that. Woj even tweeted that they picked him, and then he said, "Wait, hold on, no, they're getting Sam Decker." Decker is someone I've never been able to get a great read on. He doesn't excite me, but maybe we're at the point in the draft where I shouldn't be as worried about that. I don't trust his shooting quite so much, but, you know, he is a relatively athletic guy, another guy who maybe could play a little bit of four for you in bench units. So, you know, I think he's I don't think he's ever really going to be able to score one-on-one in the NBA. That's my question, right? How is he going to score points? I mean, maybe it's just effort and make some open threes. You know, that's really what I see, and maybe some straight line drives now and again. He's not someone who seems to have like a ton of moves that, you know, at an NBA level. So that's what I feel about him. Do you feel differently about him?
I feel about the same. I was surprised that certain models and people had him higher than I thought they did. I thought this was about the right range, but this being about the right range assumed that a few guys were going to be gone that weren't, Tyus Jones being one of them. And I could see him, you know, working as a rotation player. It's hard for me to see him as a starter in the league. And you can say, well, you know, he's the 18th pick, so it's fine to have a guy who's probably not going to be a starter. But they still have a really clear, we talked about how you don't want to do need, but there were a lot of point guards in this part of the draft that would be very useful for the Rockets, even though Patrick Beverley, you know, will be there next year by all assumptions. They actually have something there that they need, and unless they're going to make some sort of wholehearted shift with a guy like, you know, moving Ariza and stuff, they're a team that is good enough right now that they can actually think about the present. And, you know, maybe you're not getting a guy, you're not drafting a guy who's going to play 30 minutes a game for you, but if you could get 20 minutes or 10 minutes from a guy like Jerry and Grant, I would like that more.
Yeah, during, and to be clear also, on these guys outside of the top 10, most of them, Payne I watched a ton of because I just really enjoy watching him. But, you know, I'm really at kind of 30 minutes, 45 minutes worth of film on most of these guys. So you please feel free to take what I'm saying about a lot of these guys with a total grain of salt.
Yeah, same for me.
I mean, of course, like, lack of expertise has never prevented me from expressing my opinion. But, yeah, I think that Grant, I liked this trade for the Knicks. Let's start there because Tim Hardaway, not really, you know, a terrible defensive player, you know, can shoot the ball, doesn't really add a whole lot more. And there's 2 years of cross control left for him on his rookie contract, 4 years for Grant. I thought this was a really nice trade for Phil Jackson. Another time, really, where I think he played a bit more for the future than you might have expected in a, for a team that is ostensibly win now with Carmelo where he is. So, yeah, I mean, I like that aspect of the trade. I honestly don't really know what to think about Grant. I probably would have preferred Tyus Jones. Grant didn't do much in the couple of games that I watched to really blow me away, you know, but seems like someone who could just be like a solid backup point guard type. I don't really see him as a starter level, but he does at least have good size for the position, so maybe he can even play off the ball a little bit.
Yeah, and I also, while we're talking about that, I like the trade conceptually, especially for the Knicks. Getting that pick for Tim Hardaway is amazing. At the exact same degree, I hated this trade for the Hawks. Because Tim Hardaway Jr., I don't see, you talk about the Hawks, they're a very present team. I don't see how he makes them meaningfully better. And the Hawks need to be good. You know, they're a team that is very good right now. And not only that, do you get that point, the short-term part of it, but 2 years from now, you're going to have to pay him a fair value. You know, that's the cap's going to be high then. He's going to be a restricted free agent. I mean, maybe you get a little bit lucky if teams get scared away, but I don't think they're going to be scaring NBA off saying, oh, we're going to match everything. So you don't get that benefit either. You get a guy who's on a shorter contract who is not a clear perfect fit for what you're doing, if assuming you're bringing back Damari Carroll, which they better.
A couple more points here. Tom Haberstroh tweeted out a good point, which was that Hardaway put up over 20 points in the last game of the season against the Hawks, or down the end of the last game of the season.
Wasn't Doc Rivers!
And so that maybe this is like the danger again of having the coach in charge. And, oh, this guy played one good game against us, so now we're going to... I mean, I don't think... They don't strike me as that hasty of an organization, but it is something to note. Maybe it's just pure coincidence. All right, so let's just do quick hitters on these last 10 guys here, or last 11 guys. Daylon Wright, a guy that the stats really liked, Kevin Pelton really liked. Excellent defensive player, really, really good hands. They improved their perimeter D a lot by getting him, which is a big weakness, especially with General Grievous and Lou Williams. Wright, offensively, not really a fantastic fit. Potentially could play next to Lowry because Lowry can shoot. Wright is not a good shooter. But I don't see any way that Wright and DeRozan are really maximized playing next to one another since neither of them can shoot out of the backcourt. Maybe he gets a little better at just shooting a set shot. That's where his three-point shooting improved. He was pretty terrible off the dribble. But, you know, a guy who can pass and will improve their perimeter D. And really at that point in the draft, you just want to get someone who can play, you know, regardless of fit. If they think he can play, and a lot of models indicate that he can, and probably also someone who can contribute a little bit right away, given that he's 23. All right, good. All right, you want to do the next one, Justin Anderson?
Justin Anderson, play UVA. I'm not sold on him. I think that he has, you know, he's a decent shooter. I mean, some people think he's a lot better than that. I don't see, like with Sam Decker, I don't see how he starts in the league. I could see him being a rotation player, but I didn't really love him.
Yeah, he adds some toughness and athleticism on the perimeter to a team that had really nobody who could guard at the wing positions by the end of the year. So that really kind of fills the need. And, you know, I could see him getting some minutes off the bench. So Dallas is a team that traditionally has been willing to play rookies if they can play. And so maybe, I mean, not a terrible pick. I mean, I'm not, you know, nothing really. He wasn't one of the guys that I kind of saw and was like, oh, yeah, like this is one of the guys I really zeroed in on in this late range. Bobby Portis for the Bulls, someone who is projected to be in the late lottery or late teens, and they are, quote-unquote, ecstatic that he fell to them. Big surprise. He is a Bulls type of pick, hard worker, not extremely athletic, but pretty versatile. Think of him as kind of a Taj Gibson potential replacement. The idea that he could play the wing is not correct. He's a four-man all the way.
Maybe even a little five.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably overstating a little bit, maybe in small lineups, but you know, not quite the shot blocker that someone like Gibson is, but maybe a little bit better of an offensive feel and jump shot. So, I mean, sort of a jack of all trades. You know, doesn't have a super standout skill other than his effort, but I think someone who is a totally decent pick for the Bulls at 22.
Yeah, we'll move on, I guess, to a guy that I think we'll both talk about, which is Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, Arizona product. I had him as the best perimeter defender in this draft. I think that even though his offensive game needs a lot of improvement, if you're that good defensively, you will find a place in the league. I really like him a lot. He can, to me, he's primarily a three. I trust that he can defend fours and twos. I mean, I don't think he's not Ron Artest in that way. It's like, oh, you just put him on the best guy, but he's very good. And those guys stick. And he got drafted by Portland. I loved him on that team. And then he got drafted from Mason Plumlee, traded for Mason Plumlee.
Yeah, I think, you know, nobody is Tony Allen defensively. You know, as Kevin Pelton pointed out, that like, oh, his floor is Tony Allen. Like, no, that's not true. He's maybe the best perimeter defender of the last 10 years. But, you know, I think someone who definitely can be an upper echelon wing defender and at least has some offensive skills. Like, he can finish at the basket. He'll dunk on you. He's very similar, actually, to Stacey Ogman, down to being left-handed and sort of having those kind of plastic man finishes. And, you know, maybe even a little bit more athletic with more length than Ogman had. So, and just as broke of a jumper, unfortunately. But maybe he'll come around to that. He's going to have to totally rework his form. At least can hit about 70% from the line. So he's not a total disaster there. But, you know, real good feel for cutting. And someone who's just is a great teammate. And I think could have right about where he should have gone, maybe just due to the lack of upside because of his shooting. But also someone that I think it's hard to imagine, unless he gets hurt, that he's not going to be in the league for quite some time.
Yeah,
if he were ever to wash out of the league, he could go to Europe and be an undersized four and be a monster there.
Yeah, absolutely true. Tyus Jones fell to 24, ended up Cleveland had the pick, and I think everybody thought, oh, they're going to get Tyus Jones or RJ Hunter. They trade it to Minnesota, which is close to Tyus's hometown, I believe. I don't know exactly where it is. I just heard it was in the area for 31 and 36. That's a trade that I think would have made sense for Cleveland if those guys weren't on the board, but I think we're both really high on Tyus Jones.
Yeah, I think that the Cleveland trading back into the second round, I think it might even be 31 and 36 might even be good value. I forget where he shows up. Kevin Pelton did a great draft value chart today. I would imagine that 31 and 36 is actually worth more than 24 on that. But I think Cleveland wanted to get out of the first round and not have to give up guaranteed money that was just going to boost their luxury tax bill, which you know, is going to be absolutely astronomical. I mean, with they bring everybody in, Jones is like $1 million salary. They probably end up costing him almost $5 million in total. So they traded down to 31 and 36. They got Seti Osman, who I really like at 31, out of Turkey. Talked about him a little bit with KP last week. But you know, he's not going to come over until 2017, Draft Express reports. And then, you know, they also got Rakeem Christmas, who not someone I'm real familiar with, but, you know, another guy that they basically, you know, they can cut him if he doesn't, they either cut him or they can have him at the rookie minimum, which would be a little bit over $500,000, either way. So that's, I think that trade back for Cleveland is probably more motivated by the luxury tax and completely understandable. If they want to save a little bit there because they'll be spending a ton in other respects. But, yeah, I do think Jones ultimately could help them, but probably not this year.
And I really, really, really like Tyus Jones in Minnesota. He can provide – he can be their primary ball handler off the bench. He can grow into it. And also, I really like a backup point guard, primary ball handler who can scale up when the point guard gets hurt or whatever happens, or if they get traded. And that's a good thing to have when you have Ricky Rubio. I love Ricky Rubio. I've said before, he's my basketball spirit animal. But you need to have a guy behind him who can scale up when need be. I like Tyus Jones a lot. And you get him for 4 years at a cheap price, and then you get to match on him if you want to later on.
Yeah, they needed more guys who can pass on that team. So, and Jones can definitely do that. I think he's someone who can really improve his outside shooting given his free throw percentage. I don't think he's going to be able to hit the NBA three right away, but I think he can get there to be pretty good. And even someone who eventually could play alongside Rubio. Rubio can certainly guard most wing or shooting guards pretty well. But, you know, Jones will have to improve his shot a lot to do that. But they really desperately need that backup point guard. Zach LaVine, not an adequate solution at backup point guard, was by advanced metrics one of the worst guys in the league. So I think even in that respect, he might help right away a little bit. But yeah, I like the pick. I think he could have gotten a lot higher to me. I think he's probably the fourth best point guard in the draft, as far as I'm concerned, in a long-term potential sense.
So then we go on to 25, and you have the Memphis Grizzlies taking Jarrell Martin from LSU. Jonathan Charks, he's a guy I admittedly didn't watch a ton of LSU. SEC basketball that wasn't Kentucky this year was not my favorite thing to watch. But he has talent. Jonathan Charks wrote a nice piece kind of talking about him and his potential role sliding between some defensive positions. He has talent. I'm not completely sure how he fits in. You know, like, he's another one of those guys, maybe a rotation player, not a starter. But I admit that I didn't watch a ton of him.
Yeah, I didn't either. I mean, I think it's more interesting because there are rumors that he had been promised by Memphis. Drafts Express reported that. Woj retweeted him. But then Chris Vernon out of Memphis said no way, they did not promise him. They were crestfallen that Jones was not there, and they would have taken him if he hadn't been taken one pick before. San Antonio, Nikola Milutinov.
Milutinov is how I've heard it said.
Yeah, Milutinov. Plays for Partizan in Belgrade, 7'1", pretty athletic for a guy that size, you know, not really, not as stiff, can finish dunks inside, plays hard, runs the floor relatively well for his size. I didn't really see a ton of shot blocking out of him, but young guy, getting minutes already for a good team in Europe and has been for quite some time. Absolutely going to get stashed because, and this is a good time to bring in a little bit of CBA stuff. The way it works for a first-round pick on the cap is there is a – even if you don't sign him, there is a cap hold for 100% of what his rookie scale amount would be, which would be a little bit under $1 million in the case of Milutinov. But because San Antonio is going to be trying to use cap space, you know, potentially Aldridge is being talked about as a front-runner for him, getting Milutinov off the books is important, and the way you can do that is if you sign a written agreement with both the player and the team saying he's not going to play for us this year, then his cap hold disappears and it comes back on at the next year's rookie scale amount after that league year starts. If you don't sign that agreement and you don't actually sign the guy to a contract, the cap hold stays on the books until either the start of the year or the date that he signs with another team not in the NBA, whichever is later. So even if he signs, you know, he'll still be signed with Partizan. If he didn't sign that letter, he would still be on the books for them until the start of the NBA year. So, but I would presume that there have been talks already that he's willing to sign that letter and he will sign it post-haste to give them that extra space, and the thought will be that he'll come over later on.
Yeah, I still like some of the guys on the board, but I can understand why they could be making the reasonable calculus that $500,000 is important to them.
Larry Nance, don't really know anything about him other than that a lot of people thought he was a reach with the Lakers, number 27. Looks pretty athletic, son of former Cavaliers and Suns forward Larry Nance. You got anything else to say about him? I honestly don't really know anything about him.
I saw a little bit of him when he was younger and didn't think much of it, but apparently he got a lot better, so props to him.
RJ Hunter, a guy that you loved to Boston at 28.
Yeah, RJ Hunter is a guy that I seriously considered putting in my top 10. That's how much I think of him. People have talked about, oh, he was a bad shooter this year. he shot the crap out of the ball 2 years ago, and he was put in a situation where he had to do a lot more of the offensive load on a Georgia State team that, you know, they had Kevin Ware, but they didn't have a ton of talent. And he was a guy who, when people have talked about before, if you ramp up usage, generally your efficiency goes down. He's not going to have a high usage in the pros. He's going to be a kind of more of a set shooter guy. I like his defensive potential. He's a very good passer for an off guard. And I love the guy. I think that he's a player who making his role smaller will make him a much, much, much better player. I would have seriously considered taking him in the lottery, and Boston should be thrilled they got him this late.
Yeah, and he has as a guy who potentially has really elite skills. He'll bomb it from anywhere. Also really improved his passing this year. Kind of skinny, though. Maybe not the greatest athlete in the world. And, you know, who knows how well he'll be able to defend. But I thought that, you know, Boston definitely needed a shooter on the wing. I mean, they've got James Young already. They've got him. Those are two lottery picks now. I mean, lottery in the sense of let's see whether they work out or not. Two lottery tickets would probably be more accurate to say. But we'll see. Maybe now they have – if one of those guys hits, then now you got a shooter. Chris McCullough coming off a torn ACL, freshman, really athletic. Don't know much more about him, out of Syracuse to Brooklyn at number 29. Anything to say on him?
Saw a little bit of him, didn't love him, ended up liking what Brooklyn did much more when they added Rondae Hollis-Jefferson too.
Yeah, and we got to talk about that trade once we get through the first round. Kevon Looney, it was even reported that he just was the last guy in the green room, just left his table, and then I guess came back when Golden State picked him. I really liked him when I first saw him at the 2013 Adidas Nations. He averaged like 4.5 offensive rebounds a game in his tournament games there. I compared him at the time to kind of a Kirilenko type. Gets a lot of steals, blocked some shots in that. Looked pretty explosive. Looked less explosive to me at UCLA. Could have been a function of this lingering hip issue that ostensibly caused him to fall. But I think, you know, he's 19. Great pick for Golden State, where he's not going to play anyway. If he does have an issue, he can get healthy, and, you know, there won't be any pressure for him to play. And, you know, supposedly he was also red flagged with a degenerative back, according to Draft Express. When Bob Myers was interviewed, he said essentially that their doctors hadn't gotten their hands on him. They don't really know, but I think they just liked him on film at that point. And with 30 and without a place to play him next year anyway, why not draft him as a good potential value and someone who has some upside? I think what's most notable about this, though, is that they did not trade this pick for in concert with David Lee.
Correct, and that's it. We talked about it in the Golden State preview. That was a major storyline for this draft. And Kevon Looney, I liked him a lot more before his time at UCLA than I did during his time at UCLA. But I see a very good player in there somewhere. The question is whether he will bring it out. But the parallel that I made, and it's a cross-sport thing, but it's a same geographic area thing, is the San Francisco 49ers the last couple of years have done a lot of what a lot of people call medical redshirting or gray shirting of guys. So they take a guy who they think is good, who fell because he's not going to be good right away, and because they have other people. And there is a value to that. I mean, we talked about how, if you're taking a guy, you know, after the lottery, if you're taking a guy in the 20s, you know, you're not going to have that high of an expectation for it. So if there's a guy that you think is better than those guys and his weakness is that he's not going to be healthy for a year or 2 years, then that's fine. You just won the championship. I think Looney's a 4. I like him a lot defensively.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely a 4. But, I mean, the one thing that was a positive for him out of his season at UCLA was he shot 40% on threes, which, yep, you know, I think was a little bit more of a question. And you see if he has the length, good rebounder, pretty good dribbler. He actually played a little point guard out of Milwaukee, playing high school in Milwaukee. So all of those, I mean, maybe he can sort of end up being a little bit of a Draymond Green light someday as a guy who can play power forward, guard in the post, rebound, and then, you know, catch on short rolls and attack on offense. But, you know, that's probably getting ahead of ourselves. I think it's just, you know, it's a wild card pick and, you know, probably a decent one.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been incredible if they could have gotten RJ Hunter, just because another guy who can shoot the ball like that. But Looney is a nice, if you want to call it, settling pick that RJ Hunter wasn't on the board.
So let's talk about that trade. I mean, we'll get into a few second-rounders that we liked. So the trade was...
I have it if you don't.
Yeah. No, Rondé and Steve Blake for Mason Plumlee and who else?
Wasn't it Connaughton?
Pat Connaughton, who was drafted later on, shooter out of Notre Dame, also has a pretty high, pretty good vertical. What do you think of that trade?
It's strange because I had been harping so long that I thought Mason Plumlee is overrated that I think he actually got relatively decent value. You know, like it was, they talked about that they were getting a lottery, that they wanted a lottery pick, and I'm like, good luck with that. But I feel like even though Mason Plumlee has plenty of physical talent, I can definitely see where Rondé's going to succeed in the league. I can see how that's going to work. And there's a part of me that just thinks that's great. You know, you can do that with him. And Mason Plumlee is a nice player. I mean, he was a member of Team USA. We can talk about that. But I don't see how he is like a starting caliber center. To me, he doesn't do what a center needs to do well enough. And then he doesn't bring anything else that you would go, okay, you know, like let's say theoretically you were going to play Frank Kaminsky or Kristaps Porzingis at center. You'd be like, okay, well, they're bringing something else at the center position that justifies that they can't rim protect or, you know, be a great defensive rebounder. I don't see the pathway for him to that. And so he's a good player, but I think he's more of a rotation guy than a starter. And when you're trading the 23 pick for him, that's what you're getting.
Well, it's interesting because I can't remember exactly what pick he was. He might have actually been 23. Either, I think he was actually 22 2 years ago. So taking out Connaughton and Blake from the deal, I mean, I think let's just say it's Plumlee for Rondé. You've got, I guess, two more years of rookie salary cost control on Plumlee, but you also have the certainty that you already know he's an NBA player and he's pretty good and maybe even could become a decent starting center, you know, and can play some pick and roll with and catch some alley-oops in a different way with Damian Lillard. I like the fit there offensively, and he is pretty athletic. Maybe he'll start to get it more on defense than he already has. He's 25, as we've talked about on past programs. But, you know, so not that much ceiling left to explore there. But on the other hand, you know, we know he's an NBA player. We have no idea. I mean, we don't that whether Rondé Hollis-Jefferson at 23 is an NBA player. And so now, granted, you have 4 years of him if he does turn out to be an NBA player cost-controlled rather than the two remaining with Plumlee. So it's an interesting kind of challenge trade there, you know, where you're taking more certainty but less years of that certainty versus, you know, more uncertainty but more cost control and maybe you could say a little more upside than Plumlee has if Rondé can ever figure out how to shoot. So I kind of like the trade. I think that the Nets desperately needed athleticism. I think this also would seem to indicate that Lopez and Plumlee are not a good fit together, and that they intend to re-sign Lopez or that he may not opt out. I think they feel it would be an indication that they feel reasonably well about that if they're willing to move on from Plumlee. So, you know, I think it's actually a decent trade for both teams. We'll see who ends up winning, but I understand it from both sides.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. I guess for the second round, we should just talk about guys that we either, I guess it's mostly going to be guys, picks we liked or knew something about.
Yeah, Montrezl Harrell, number 32 to Houston, was interesting to me mostly. I think he actually can, you know, he's another kind of backup center type, basically. I mean, he's got a center's game and a power forward's body, and he's actually pretty short, but he has a 7'4 wingspan and a good standing reach. You know, another guy who can kind of come in and be tough, compete at a, those kind of backup center minutes with someone like Clint Capella. But he's most noteworthy for me because if he came out after his freshman year and they won the national championship, I think he actually would have gotten drafted much higher. Just another indication that if you are a first rounder at any time, go. And now he's a second rounder. He's not going to get likely a guaranteed contract. Maybe he will a little bit, but you know, not a 4-year guaranteed deal as most first rounders end up being. And now he's starting his career 2 years later as well. So you're missing out on another 2 years of earnings and making less. If you are a first rounder, go.
Complete agreement. Sorry. Wow, I phrased that wrong. I agree on Harrell. I'll pull to a guys a little bit later down. Joseph Young of Oregon went to Indiana. I think he can score. I think he's not a starter in any way, shape, or form. But the guy I talked about in my thing for Real Gem is, you know, guys like Lou Williams have a lot of value in the league. I don't think he's as good on paper as Lou Williams has been, but I think he has some potential. And Andrew Harrison, I like him as an off guard who can be a secondary ball handler. Memphis is a strange but kind of compelling spot for him because they having ball handlers for them is nice. I don't trust his jumper yet, but I think that it'll be a little bit better because it'll be more off the ball. Those are two guys that I thought, I'm like, oh, that could work.
Yeah, I think Young, at least, you know, the type of player he is, if they hit on him, Indiana can definitely use that kind of gunner type on the second unit, a second unit that's always really struggled to score, especially if they don't end up bringing back Rodney Stuckey. Let's see. Jordan Mikey, I think, is good. He is probably more of a Taj Gibson type than the guy I trumpeted as a Taj Gibson replacement, because he actually does have that level of shot blocking, one of the best shot blockers in the NCAA. Has a decent mid-range jumper, a little short, but, you know, with his long arms. And, I mean, he's really the only guy on that Boston roster right now who can block a shot. So I think he actually will have a chance to carve out a role there in the next couple of years. And maybe, you know, with his playing him at power forward, you can feel a little bit better about running someone like Olynyk or Zeller out of there.
I also like JP.
Or not out of there, but out there. Yeah.
I also want to bring up JP Tokoto. I thought it was hilarious that the Sixers, again, took a really athletic guy who we might end up seeing put up some really ridiculous stats if he gets minutes. I don't love him as an NBA player, but I think that there is some potential there, and he might get some time on the Sixers.
Guillermo Hernan Gomez, another guy I talked about with Pelton last week. You guys should listen to that and also the Mike Schmitz podcast as well to get even more detail on some of these guys. He is now on the Knicks, a guy who I think fits well in the triangle as a heady guy, passer, posts up a little bit. Not really an athlete, not someone who protects the rim, but notable as a kind of a stats all-star. John Gavone had a stat that only seven guys in ACB history have ever posted a PER of 20 at age 20 or younger, and there's some pretty good names: Splitter, Ricky Rubio, Rudy Fernandez, Mirotic, and Scola among them. So if that's any indication, maybe he's pretty good. It's interesting, though, he played for Sevilla, same team as Kristaps Porzingis, and then also the point guard on that team, Nikola Radicevic, also was drafted. And when you look at that, three guys drafted off of that team, they finished 12-22 and almost got relegated, Sevilla. Now, granted, that's a lot of young guys, but it shows you how good that league is. If they have three dudes drafted off that team, that was really actually one of the worst in the league.
Yeah, that's really impressive. I had forgotten that they had a third guy get drafted from that team.
I think that's about all I had. I mean, the other guy, Dakari Johnson, I think another guy who he'll probably spend the year in the T League, I would guess, with OKC. Maybe they'll give him a little bit of a guarantee and then waive him or something, but they're going to be in the tax. So they probably, and they also have roster management problems. So doubt they bring him over.
Can we talk about the Milwaukee took Norman Powell, which is another athletic kind of combo guard who can defend? It's ridiculous how many of those guys they have now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Norman Powell's going to be any good, frankly. But
I'm not a huge fan of his either. And considering he's a UCLA guy, that says something.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's funny that the two guys in Christian Wood and Cliff Alexander that I was going to, whenever they got picked in the second round, I was going to say, all right, these are good upside plays. These guys have a lot of potential. Ended up not getting picked at all, which was, you know, we'll see. Maybe nothing ever happens to those guys, and I'll be proven wrong. But I think with the potential they had, I would have liked to have seen them picked. But that's pretty much all I got here on this. Anyone else you wanted to hone in on?
Not really in the second round. I think that there are a lot of guys, I admit, that this year I didn't watch as much college as I like, so there weren't a ton. I feel like the French-Canadian in my genetic heritage should mention Olivier Allon, which is from Quebec, so I should say that just to say it. But yeah, I thought that the one thing that was surprising to me with this draft was that I thought teams were going to fall in love with guys and they were going to move around to make sure they got their player, and we really didn't see much of that. And that speaks to how I think a lot of us thought a lot of guys were about at the same level. And, you know, so it's kind of whoever falls. But I was surprised at how little of that there was.
Oh, we neglected to talk about the John Lure for Andrew Harrison trade, Memphis to Phoenix. So, I mean, Andrew Harrison, I don't think he's going to be any good. I wanted to like him just as a guy who was so highly recruited 2 years ago, but I think he shot like the lowest percentage on twos ever in the Draft Express database. It's like 37% on twos. And, you know, I mean, I like his size and ability to dribble as a true point guard, but other than that, doesn't really offer a whole much. And also has a reputation of being a bit of a surly guy. So I despite the kind of name recognition there, I don't particularly see him working out, but you know, it is what it is, I guess. It's not like they had to give up a guy who was really part of their rotation in John Lue or anything.
Just from a pure GM perspective, I'll say mine first. I think it was Masai Ujiri for a thing that didn't really affect this draft that much, but is there anybody who you thought did a standout job?
Oh, I would say Philly, because they easily could have picked a guy, said, all right, we have Noel and we have Embiid, we can't take another center, and just gone for another guy that they didn't like as much or wasn't going to be as good of a player. And I think, you know, they don't know whether Noel even is a sure thing. He's had injury issues. Embiid has injury issues. Nobody knows what he's going to be, even if he's healthy. And even if those guys were pretty good, you know, just get the good guy. You're not anywhere close to contending. So I thought that, you know, Sam Hinkie, I mean, it's not a surprise. You know, I think he treats this as, you know, sort of a little bit more dispassionately and, you know, as an asset accumulation game, but that's the right way to treat it when their franchise is where it is. And at least, you know, nobody can complain that, like, they picked a guy who's not going to contribute this year or, like, won't be helpful at all. So, I would look at them, and then I would say, to me, the big losers would be New York. I don't really like Porzingis that much. And then Sacramento. Those would be the two, I think, for passing on Moody. I don't really like that. And then Charlotte with Kaminsky. Those would probably be the biggest ones that show up to me.
One other thing I'll add in terms of they're kind of a double winner is Denver, because they have New York's pick. They have the right to swap picks with New York next year, and it's unprotected. There's no shielding on that at all. And their decision to go more long-term, while obviously they will probably go more short-term in free agency and with their cap space, them possibly not being a playoff team is a huge boost potentially to Denver.
Yeah, that may be true. I mean, I think the Knicks will probably have a better record than Denver next year, given that there you can pick up some guys in free agency. And, you know, I think whoever New York got, as we said at the top of the show, it doesn't matter. Like, they weren't going to be a winning player regardless next year. Yeah, I mean, I think, and maybe we'll see, you know, L.A. is the other one. I think Okafor was better than Russell. I think that I even liked Moutier better, although I would say that Russell has a higher upside than Moutier. There are more questions to answer about Russell. So that it'll be really interesting to see what happens there. You know, I mean, it was always assumed it was going to be Okafor, and then all of a sudden it was Russell. Maybe it was all along and there was a smoke screen or what. You know, no one seemed to know where they were going. But, yeah, I mean, that's going to be a decision that I think, you know, whether it's Okafor or Russell, one way or the other, is going to be remembered for a very long time.
Yeah.
All right, that's it. Let's get you guys out of here. This was probably our longest podcast ever, but, you know, big surprise. We got a lot to say about these guys. And we will be back. I think we're going to try and record over the weekend, since we weren't able to record yesterday, and try to get into more free agency previews. We got all sorts of news about guys opting in, guys opting out, Aldridge potentially leaving, you know, rumors galore, and, you know, free agency starts pretty quickly here too. So, and I think we're also going to try and have Dan Feldman on for what we hope is going to be a pretty unique, basically mock off-season podcast. That should be coming in the next couple of days too, but we'll try and give you guys a little bit more of a specific preview of at least some of the more interesting teams. Doesn't seem like we're going to get to all of them before free agency actually starts, but hope you enjoyed this one. You made it all the way here through to the end, and we'll be back pretty soon. Follow me on Twitter at Nate Duncan NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. Please subscribe on iTunes, give us a review that doesn't say that we went on for too long today on iTunes. That's always appreciated. And we'll talk to y'all next time. Thanks.